If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
64 years ago this month, three inmates planned and executed an escape from Alcatraz prison on an island in San Francisco Bay. Maybe you visited that place when you were in San Francisco. It's an interesting place to go. Probably the most famous jailbreak in history. Experts contend to this day that the place was inescapable and they must have drowned in the waters before they got to the mainland. But this is an obsession. People have been studying this and trying to determine whether they did live. And if they did live, where did they go and how did they live out their lives? And with us to discuss the details you may not know is David Widner, who is a nephew of two of the escapees. He's also the co-author of the book Escaping Alcatraz, The Untold Story of the Greatest Prison Break in American History, which is a winner of an International Book Award for Best True Crime. David, so nice to have you here. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on.
So I want to first tell us about who the inmates were that escaped and how you were related to two of them.
Okay, so John Anglin and Clarence Anglin, along with Frank Morris. John Anglin and Clarence Anglin are my two uncles, my mom's two brothers.
Okay, and what were they convicted of to get them into Alcatraz?
Well, they were convicted of bank robbery. Growing up, they committed petty crimes and got in a lot of trouble. And one day they decided that, you know, they were going to rob a bank with a toy gun and go off and live happily ever after with their girlfriends. And one of my uncles, Alfred, was involved in that bank robbery. He had just got married. And they thought they could pull this off with a toy gun, and a couple of weeks later, they got caught.
And they weren't violent criminals, though, and that's one of the things that I think it's important to know. They came from a very poor background, right? There were a bunch of kids in that family. Were there 12?
There was 14.
14?
There was 14 kids in that family. Yeah, they grew up very poor. There was seven girls and seven boys. And the reason that they got into, you know, the crime life was they were picked on in school as kids because of their clothes. They didn't have nice clothes to wear, and my grandparents had a hard time getting them to go to school and stay in school. So they started doing, you know, petty crimes, robbing places after hours, you know, stealing batteries and, you know, different things to sell to get money to have nice clothes, they, you know, and nice things. They wanted more than what they could, you know, than they had.
Yeah. And so let's talk about what we know about how they escaped Alcatraz. And many of you may know some of this from the movies and some of the documentaries. But David, can you just tell us in your own words what this was a major plan and how long did it take for them to plan it? And what were the items of planning that they had to engage in?
Well, it took them a total of 18 months to plan it. And they obtained 52 raincoats that they made life jackets and actually made a boat out of. They constructed dummy heads out of toilet paper, toothpaste, soap, and concrete dust. And actually human hair. My Uncle Clarence took a job when they got to Alcatraz in the barber shop, and he collected the hair that they used on the dummy heads.
Oh, my goodness. And they got out through, was it a heat duct
It was a vent in the back of the cell. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they stole spoons out of the lunchroom, and they used the spoons. They broke the heads off of them and used them as little picks to pick away the concrete around the vent so that they could get the vent out.
This is what I call dedication. Of course, they had a lot of time on their hands, but still, this was a master plan. So let's talk about the possibility of them getting to shore. There, you know, there just seems to be everyone saying, oh, the water was so cold, it's shark infested, it was wavy, there's no way. But people swim in that bay all the time. Isn't there like a triathlon or something where people swim there even now?
Yes, every year thousands of people compete in that triathlon and swim it. Of course, you know, the currents is different at different times. But, you know, just so everyone knows, you know, John and Clarence grew up less than a mile away from the Tampa Bay. So as kids, that's all they did do was swim. That's really kind of all they had to do. They swam all the time. They were excellent swimmers. They knew about the tides and how the tides worked. So, you know, if the raft that they constructed didn't hold up, I believe that they were able to make the rest of it by swimming. Now, Frank Morris, I'm not sure of, but definitely John and Clarence were excellent swimmers.
Because they had the raft made out of the raincoats, but they also had, like I don't know what you want to call them, life vests, if you will, that they had on their person. Is that right?
That is true.
So they would have been buoyant, at least, you know, in swimming.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right.
So
Whitey Bulger was a mobster that was in Alcatraz at the time of the escape, and he told us, we had correspondence with him after he was captured in 2011, and he told us that in the 50s he was a scuba diver, and he actually told them how to take those raincoats, some of the raincoats, and make wetsuits out of them.
Oh my gosh. So Whitey Bulger was in on the planning, at least a little bit.
Well, yeah, he did. I won't say, you know, he was in on all of the planning, but yes, he did give them some advice on how to do that, how to line the raincoats with grease and soap and stuff to keep the water, you know, keep the body heat in. So yeah, he did play a little part in it.
Interesting. So the question is, so no bodies were ever found. And again, you could understand maybe the bodies could have been swept away in a current or eaten by sharks. But wouldn't we have found the raft? And wouldn't we have found, and I think the raft was found. You're going to tell me that.
Yeah.
And would you have found the life vest? Would those have been found too?
Yes, those were found floating. The raft was actually found on Angel Island. The authorities didn't release any of that stuff in the beginning. It was leaked out. But there was a raft found. The authorities also claimed that there was no crimes committed that night, which turned out later on to be not true. There was a car stolen that night by three individuals that later come out.
So somebody, three somebodies stole a car right, you know, near to where they could have landed on the mainland. Is that right?
Yes. There was a report of a man claiming that, they know the car was stolen. It was a blue Chevrolet. And there was a report of a man that said that three individuals in a blue Chevrolet run him off the road at a high speed. That was kind of kept under wraps for a long time, too, until it got leaked out.
I think I read an account once that an off-duty policeman or a policeman working somewhere nearby saw an odd light of a boat in the general vicinity where the inmates could have been or would have been swimming if they were heading towards shore. Do you know that story, and is that true?
I do know that story. The officer's name was Robert Chechy. He was off duty, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, he was down by the bay smoking a cigarette, and he claims that he saw a strange boat out in the bay with bright lights on. He said that it didn't look like a fisherman boat, he did make that report.
Now, there's also rumors that there was assistance from the outside in helping these inmates escape. And a man named Mickey Cohen's name has been bantered about. Who's Mickey Cohen, And do you think that he helped these three inmates, including your two uncles, escape from Alcatraz?
Well, Mickey Cohen was a Jewish mob boss out of Los Angeles, and he was serving time at Alcatraz for tax evasion. He arrived July the 28th of 61, and he was actually the only person ever bonded out of Alcatraz. He bonded out on an appeal in October the 17th of 61, and then he was returned to Alcatraz May the 14th of 62. Which was 28 days before the escape happened. And a lot of people tried to tie that to him being the one that set the boat up. And, you know, a lot of theories. There was also a lot of theories of Bumpy Johnson, Ellsworth Bumpy Johnson. He was a mob boss as well. And there was a lot of people said that he's the one that arranged the boat. A lot of stories. Over the years, I've kind of went through things and picked through things and just tried to figure out what was true and what's not true.
We're here with David Widner. He is the nephew of two of the men who tried to escape from Alcatraz and maybe lived to tell about it, at least to tell some people about it. He is the co-author of a book, Escaping Alcatraz, The Untold Story of the Greatest Prison Break in American History. I've started to read it. It's excellent. It's a really great read, and it's won an International Book Award for Best True Crime. 64 years ago this month, three inmates planned and executed an escape from Alcatraz. We have with us today David Widner, who's the nephew of two of the escapees, those being John and Clarence Anglin. And thank you for holding, David. I had a nice texter who asked about Frank Morris. Was he was a brainiac, wasn't he? Wasn't he known to have a very high IQ? Is that true?
That is correct. He was tested, and he had an IQ of 133.
Ah, okay. And what was he? In for a bank robbery?
Yes, he was.
Okay. All right. So before we proceed with what may have happened to these three, I'm just going to talk a little bit about you personally. And you're related to two of these people who were supposedly involved in the highest profile prison break in the history of the country and maybe the world. How has this impacted you? And is it impacted your life? Do you have a lot of people clamoring to talk to you? Has it been good for you? Is it interesting for you? Is it a burden to you?
It's very interesting to me. It's really been a part of my whole life. When I was 11 years old, me and my mother were doing some yard work one day, and a black car pulls up, and two men get out in black suits, and my mom asked, "Could I help you?" And they said, "Yes, we're with the FBI, and we want to ask you some questions about your brothers." And she said, "Okay." And they said, "Have you heard or do you know where your brothers are?" And I can remember distinctly, she said, "No, I haven't heard from my brothers, and if I did know where they were, I wouldn't tell you."
That's an honest response.
And, you know, from that day forward is where my interest began. Some of my friends in the neighborhood had saw what had happened and asked me who they were, and I kind of told them a little bit about the story. And, of course, nobody believed it, you know. And so I didn't talk to anybody too much about it other than my mom. And I just became real interested in it. And one day she says, "You know, I got a box under the bed. You should go get it out and let's look in it." And turned out that she had all of the letters that they had wrote home from all of the other prisons that they had been in, including, you know, about 17 letters from Alcatraz.
Oh, interesting.
So I started going through everything and learning, you know, about them. And you was right. They had no record of any violence on their records at all. So they, you know, they were kind of good old boys, but just, you know, led a a life of petty crime to start with until the bank robbery. And then with the bank robbery, they used a toy gun, which didn't excuse the robbery. But yeah, I mean, they just wanted more out of life than what they were given.
Now, David, your mother was the sister of two of the two. Did she ever say to you, "I think they made it"? Was her gut feeling, or did she say to you, "David, if they had made it, they would have contacted me at some point to let me know or to let their mother know that they were still alive"?
Well, yes. I mean, we all believe that they made it. My grandmother said that, you know, she told the story that a few months after the escape, after the FBI quit watching the house so close, that she got woken up in the middle of the night by a knock on her window, bedroom window, and it was John and Clarence saying that, "Hey, just wanted to let you know we were okay, but we can't stay."
And was this
absolutely, the family believes, yes.
So these were real knockers, or these were ghost knockers?
Well, she said it was them.
Interesting. So let's talk about how the authorities handled this. First of all, were there ramifications to this breakout? Like, was the warden punished, or were people fired? Was this a something that kind of shook up the entire prison?
Well, it did shake up the prison. I don't know of anybody being fired over it. I know that J. Edgar Hoover, you know, they launched a massive manhunt and even brought in the National Guard to help look for him. But after a day or so and they couldn't find them, then, you know, J. Edgar Hoover said, you know, "Hey, they drowned, they washed out to sea, end of story," you know. But my question was always, well, if y'all really believe that they didn't make it, why are you still looking for them?
And did they continue looking, and who was looking? Was it the FBI? Was it the marshals? Who was looking, and what did they do, to your knowledge, to try to find them?
Well, yes, the FBI, they continued to look for them up until 1979, when they closed their part of the case. They had followed thousands of leads, and then they turned it over to the Marshal Service, which had took it over in 1979.
And do you think that the reason it was closed down so quickly by Hoover was that it was an embarrassment and was easier to say, "Hey, these people, you know what, it's true, this place is inescapable, and they drown," and it was just easier to say that than continue to really, at least, you know, in a public way, search for them?
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure it was a very big embarrassment for him that somebody did make it out. There had been other escape attempts, and there was even one that they never found them, that was not really out in the public. But yeah, it was an embarrassment for him. But also, you know, the prison was old and it was deteriorating, and you know, it was a lot of money to keep it open. And those are some of the reasons is that they closed it down.
And it was pretty quickly after the escape, wasn't it? Wasn't within a year?
Yeah, it was like 9 months later is when they closed the prison down. There was actually Johnny Clarence and Morris's escape was not the last escape. There was another escape after that, a few months after their escape, where an individual made it all the way to the San Francisco Bridge before they, you know, found him.
Interesting. And the escape that you talked about prior to the one we're addressing, how many people escaped in that one? I think you said that prior to your uncle's escape, there was another escape attempt?
There was an escape attempt after his.
Oh, just after, okay.
I think there was 30-some-odd attempts overall. Most were captured or killed. But, yeah, there was an escape after their escape where the individual was caught.
So let's talk a little bit before we take another break. There was a letter written to the San Francisco Police Department in 2013, but it wasn't made public, I believe, until maybe 5 years later. Can you tell us about what that letter said and why it was withheld from the public domain for 5 years?
Yeah, so they, the San Francisco Police Department received a letter in 2013 from someone claiming to be John Anglin, saying that he was sick with cancer and that his brother Clarence had already died and Frank Morris had passed away. And he was reaching out for help, for medical help, and in exchange for doing a year in jail. They kept that quiet. It leaked out to the newspapers in 2018 is when we found out about it. And my question to the authorities is, you know, why didn't y'all tell the family? And their response was, well, we don't have to tell the family. This is still an active case. We didn't find the letter credible because of the handwriting. It didn't match. And my question was, well, maybe they had somebody else write it for them. I mean, how do you know it wasn't credible?
Did you ever see the letter?
I have seen the letter.
Okay. And you have those letters that your mother shared with you that were written from various prisons. Did you ever line them up and see if there were similarities?
I did, and not really too much similarities. It was a lot different. But then again, you know, at that age, I mean, John would have been 83 years old, and the handwriting would surely be different.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, it could have been that someone else wrote it for him, especially if he were sick. We were talking to David Widner. He's the nephew of two of the escapees and co-author of the book Escaping Alcatraz, The Untold Story of the Greatest Prison Break in American History.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
We are talking to David Widner. He is the author of the book Escaping Alcatraz, The Untold Story of the Greatest Prison Break in American History. And his uncles were two of those people, John and Clarence Anglin. Welcome back. And let me go back to this letter that we were just talking about before break. It was years and years after the escape. 2013, the San Francisco Police Department receives a letter purportedly from John Anglin, saying that he would trade a year in prison for medical treatment for his cancer. What did the police do with that letter? Was there a way to try to contact John? Did he leave a contact number or address?
Oh. They would announce it on TV, then he would come forward and you know, tell them where he was. They claimed that they done fingerprints and they couldn't get any matches. So they just kind of discarded it as a hoax.
And what's your gut feeling on that? Do you think it was a hoax?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I think it could have been John reaching out. It's very possible. I wish they would have told us in the beginning when they received the letter. But yeah, it's hard to say. There's been a lot of people make claims over the years, and that's one of the things. They have chased leads down, you know, thousands and thousands of leads. So it's really hard to tell.
So there's a rumor, you know, a rumor or an urban legend or whatever, that your uncles and maybe the third man, Frank Morris, made it all the way to Brazil. How did that rumor get out? And if they did make it to Brazil, how in the world would they have gotten there?
Well, that rumor started with an individual that came to the family in 1992, claiming that his name was Fred Breezy, claiming that he knew the boys as kids, and he was in South America in Brazil, and happened to run into them in a bar in Rio.
Oh, my gosh.
yeah. And he told a story. And like I said, you know, there's been a lot of people that, that wanted to insert themselves into this story. He actually got paid $1,000 from Inside Edition to tell this story. I kind of found it kind of wild and kind of out there when he told the story. Some of the stuff just didn't make sense. He had their names wrong. But he gave my mother some pictures that he had took in Brazil when he was there. And one of those pictures was two individuals standing by a termite mound. And later on, that picture become the subject of, you know, it being John and Clarence. Over the years, there's been six or seven different facial recognition experts that has come back and said that 99% sure it was them. I have recently uncovered information that will prove that to be wrong.
Interesting.
Yes. It will be coming out in a few weeks. I can't really talk a whole lot about it, but I can say for sure 100% that that photo that has been floating around everywhere for the last 10 years is not John and Clarence Angler.
Okay. And is there any, I guess what I'd like to ask you is, well, actually, I have a texter who said, how long was your uncle's sentence and how many years did they have left on their sentences when they escaped?
So when they went for the first trial at a federal level in 1958, they give them 15 years. They were sent to Atlanta to start serving their time. They brought them back to Montgomery, Alabama at a state level and charged them again with 15 years. So they had a total of 30 years.
Wow. Okay. So they had a lot left on their sentence.
Yes.
A lot left to lose. Do you know if any family members over the years received any communications from any of these people?
Yes, my grandmother received Christmas cards the first few years after the escape that come in the mail. They hadn't been through the post office. They wasn't marked or stamped, but they were Christmas cards to her, and they were signed by John and Clarence Angler.
How did they get to be mailed to her without any idea that there was a stamp on them?
Well, the thought was is they put them in the mailbox.
Wow. And do you think that they, and where did your grandmother live at the time?
She lived in Ruskin, Florida, just outside of Tampa.
And is there some idea
where they grew up at?
So there's some idea that they actually went across the country and went back to where they grew up?
Yes, they were tales that they were attendees at my grandmother's funeral. She passed away in 73, and they were two people there, two women, or they think were men dressed as women, that the FBI actually wanted to question, and they disappeared before they had a chance to question them.
Interesting. So the FBI was present at your grandmother's funeral to see if they turned up.
And they definitely was. And my grandfather, when he passed away, the FBI was there.
So if you're a betting person, and I'm not saying you are, what do you think happened? Tell me, if you were going to bet on every leg of this story, what happened to your uncles?
Well, I do believe they made it. My belief is that they made it to Mexico, and I don't think they ever left Mexico. And the reason I say that is when I was doing the book, I was looking through photos and letters, and I come across a photo of John. It was in 1958, and it was a picture of John propped up on his car. And, you know, just looking at the picture, you really couldn't tell much about it. But when I scanned it and was able to zoom in on it, the license plate on the front of the car was from Mexico. So I know that they had been to Mexico and had ties in Mexico.
Well, and it makes sense because you're on the coast there of San Francisco, and it's a drive down the coast, probably. And do you have any idea where in Mexico that would have been?
No, I do not.
Okay.
Not exactly.
And it, just without giving away anything that might be in the news coming up, and you're telling me that in August there might be some developments that are going to be publicized, and I'm really excited about that, and maybe you'll actually come on our show afterwards and we'll discuss this again. Is DNA something that can be used in any way to corroborate anything when it comes to this letter that was received by the San Francisco police or any other correspondence or anything else in your possession or in the possession of the family?
Well, there is a show coming out in August the 6th on Discovery of claims of they have found DNA, a match in Brazil. I have some family members involved in that. But I highly doubt that it's going to turn out to be conclusive. Because, like I said, the only ties that tied them going to Brazil was Fred Breezy. And we now know that his story was totally false. You know, the way that the DNA was collected and the way that the DNA was processed is going to be very questionable. You know, when you do DNA tests, it has to be done in a proper way to be accurate. So I just I have my doubts about it.
Yeah. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. And I think as soon as I know when it is, I'll get the information from you and I'll remind our listeners to watch it, because I'm certainly going to be watching it. I want to thank you so much, David, for joining me. And, you know, it's just an interesting thing to have this happen in your life. You know, it's nothing that you brought on yourself, and you just so happen to be connected with a story that is fascinating to people. And I thank you for sharing this information. I think it's a good historical lesson. And in our justice system, it's nice to hear these stories and to try to understand the real story behind something. The book, again, is Escaping Alcatraz, The Untold Story of the Greatest Prison Break in American History. David, thank you so much for joining us.